You may plan a C-section to make sure you have childcare lined up or to meet school entry cutoff dates, or your partner may have a personal or professional deadline she must meet. In Lissa Rankin's case, she desperately wanted her father, who was dying of cancer, to meet his granddaughter. Your partner's emotional recovery. Having an unplanned C-section can trigger a whole host of conflicting emotions in your partner. She, like you, may feel greatly relieved that the pain is over and the baby is safe. At the same time, it's very natural for her to second-guess herself in the decisions she made, to start wondering whether there was anything she could have done to avoid the operation or to believe she's failed because she didn't deliver vaginally. These feelings are especially common when the C-section was performed because labor failed to progress, meaning that the cervix wasn't dilating as quickly as the doctors may have thought it should, or it stopped dilating altogether despite adequate contractions. If you sense that your partner is experiencing any of these negative emotions, it's important that you help her get past them. Some doctors believe that, left unchecked, these feelings can escalate and contribute to postpartum depression. She really needs to know that no one could have done more or been stronger or braver than she was, that she didn't give in to the pain too soon, that she tried everything she could have to jumpstart a stalled labor, that another few hours of labor wouldn't have done anyone any good, and that the decision she made, or at least agreed to, was the best one, both for the baby and for herself. Some of these thoughts might seem obvious to you, so obvious that you might think they don't even need to be said at all. But they do, especially by you. You were there with her, and you know better than anyone else exactly what she went through. So being comforted and praised by you will mean a lot more to her than hearing the same words from a well-meaning relative, a nurse, or even her own doctor. Having a baby isn't some kind of a competition. As author Vicky Iovine writes, it is not designed for your personal enjoyment and fulfillment. It is not an opportunity to demonstrate your abilities or fitness. It is designed to perpetuate the species and nothing more. Not the most romantic way of looking at having a baby, but it is quite accurate. Equal opportunity trauma. Life-threatening emergencies during labor and birth are relatively rare, but they do happen, and when they do, there's no question that they're traumatic to the mother. But what about the dad? One of expectant fathers' most common fears is that their partner will die in childbirth, and seeing her go through a near-miss event brings that fear to the forefront. Marion Knight and her team at Oxford University found that the combination of not knowing what's going on, not knowing whether their partner and baby are alive or dead, and feeling powerless to do anything to help, leaves some dads with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. The results can affect everyone in the family. The men themselves rarely seek help because they don't want to be perceived as weak. They fear people will make fun of them, or they think they should ignore their own needs and focus 100% on their partner and baby. As a result, they feel more isolated and depressed as time goes on. That, plus the flashbacks associated with PTSD, can make it hard for dads to bond with their new baby. It also makes it hard for them to be there to support the new mom. Women whose partners were involved during the labor have better health outcomes than those with less involved partners, and the dad's involvement after the birth increases the likelihood that the mom will breastfeed. Communication with the medical staff during the emergency is key to helping dads cope. No question, their priority is and should be the mom and baby, but even the smallest things can make a huge difference, like the shoulder pat and reassuring words I got from one of the docs before my wife's emergency C-section. A few important facts to remember about recovery from a cesarean section. Your partner's incision will be tender or downright painful for at least several days. Fortunately, she'll undoubtedly be receiving some pain medication via IV. The nursing staff will visit quite frequently to make sure that your partner's uterus is getting firm and returning to its proper place, to see whether she's producing enough urine, and to check her bandages. Your partner will have an IV until her bowels start functioning again, usually within 24 hours after delivery. After the IV is removed, she'll start on a liquid diet, then add a few soft foods, and finally return to her normal diet. Although some doctors will have their patients skip the liquid diet and go straight to real food, well, as real as hospital food can be. Your partner will need to get up and move around. Despite the fact that a C-section is major abdominal surgery, less than 24 hours after the delivery, the nurses will probably encourage and help your partner to get out of bed and take a couple of rather painful-looking steps. The whole thing resembles a kindergarten art project. Besides stitches, your partner's incision may well be closed up with tape, glue, and/or staples. Yes, staples. Until I heard the clink as the doctor dropped them into a jar, I just assumed that my wife had been sewn up, but staples may be on the way out. Danya McKean, a researcher at Pennsylvania's Geisinger Health System, recently found that women whose cesarean incisions are closed with sutures are 80% less likely to have their wound reopen and 57% less likely to have post-operative complications than those who get stapled. The downside is that it takes 8 or 9 minutes longer to close the incision with sutures, but it's not like your partner has any place else she needs to be. An important warning. Never, never, never suggest to your pregnant partner that she have a C-section. Let your doctor make the first move. When my wife was pregnant with our second daughter, the pain she had been through during her first labor and delivery was still fresh in my mind. At one point, I told her that I was really upset by the thought that she might have to endure another horrible labor, and I suggested that she consider a C-section. I had no idea that someone could get so furious so quickly. Even though I had the very best of intentions and was sincerely thinking only of her and how to minimize her pain, she thought I was being completely insensitive. Clearly, I had underestimated how incredibly important giving birth vaginally, especially after already having had one C-section, was to her. Many of the men I've talked to have had similar thoughts about making the C-section suggestion to their partners. Most of them were wise enough not to act on their impulse, and hopefully you won't either. Telling your partner how you're feeling and what you're going through is, in most cases, the right thing to do. But when it comes to C-sections, really and truly, it's an issue that's just too hot to handle. One final thought. As I mentioned earlier, about a third of babies in the U.S. are born by C-section. That's up from 20.7% in 1996. But is that too high? Unfortunately, there's no clear answer because there are a number of complicating factors, and one of the biggest, so to speak, is obesity. According to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, more than half of pregnant women are overweight or obese. The C-section rate for normal weight women is 20.7%. For overweight women, it's 33.8%. And for obese women, it's 47.4%. Obese and overweight women also have higher rates of diabetes and hypertension and are more likely to be carrying a baby with congenital abnormalities, all of which raise the C-section rate even further. When you control for all those factors, the actual C-section rate in the U.S. is very much in line with the rates in other industrialized countries. Regardless of where you stand on the issue, cesareans are here to stay. Noted OBGYN and fertility specialist Elin Simkes believes that in a few hundred years, almost all babies will be born this way. Why? To start with, said Dr. Simkes, the human pelvis is shrinking over time. And thanks to a diet that consists more and more of sugar, carbs, and fat, babies are getting bigger. In 1965, the average baby born in the United States weighed about 6.5 pounds. Today, the average is more than 7.5 pounds. Bigger baby plus smaller pelvis equals more cesareans. It's inevitable. One of the strangest things about pregnancy, labor, and delivery is that you spend a huge amount of time preparing for the big day. Reading, researching, taking classes, seeing doctors, talking to other parents, and all that stuff. But once you've got your baby in hand, everyone says, "Great job, see you later," and then you're pretty much on your own. What you do with your baby once you get him or her home is beyond the scope of this book, but the next chapter is designed to give you some tools to get through those initial wild and crazy days as new parents. Gee, honey. Now what do we do? What's going on with the baby? For thousands of years, most people believed that newborn infants were capable only of eating, sleeping, crying, and looking around. But if you pay attention, you'll see that your new baby has an incredible arsenal of talents. Just a few hours out of the womb, your baby is already trying to communicate with you and everyone else around him. He can imitate your facial expressions and has some control over his body, can express preferences, most prefer patterned objects to plain objects and curved lines to straight ones, and he has a remarkable memory. Marshall Klaus told me about a game he played with an 8-hour-old girl in which he asked one colleague, who was a total stranger to the baby, and who isn't at this age, to hold the baby and slowly stick out her tongue. After a few seconds, the baby imitated the woman. Then Dr. Klaus took the baby and passed her around to 12 other doctors and nurses who were participating in the game, all of whom were told not to stick their tongues out. When the baby finally came back to the first doctor, she, the baby, without any prompting, immediately stuck out her tongue again. Even at just a few hours old, she had obviously remembered her friend. If you want your baby to respond to and play with you, the time to do it is when she's active and alert. During the first few months, infants are particularly responsive to high contrast, so black and white toys and patterns are often a big hit. But be patient. Infants are incredibly bright little creatures, but they have minds of their own. This means that despite your best efforts, your baby may not be interested in performing like a trained seal whenever you wish. What's going on with your partner? Physically, she's got a lot of vaginal discharge called lochia, and that will gradually change from bloody to pink to brown to yellow over the course of the next 6 weeks or so. She'll be in major discomfort if there's an episiotomy or a C-section incision. The pain will disappear over about the next 6 weeks. She'll probably be constipated and may develop hemorrhoids, hopefully not at the same time. She'll experience some breast discomfort starting about the third day after the birth, when her breasts become engorged with milk. If she's breastfeeding, her nipples may be sore for about 2 weeks. She'll gradually start losing weight. She'll be exhausted, especially if her labor was long and difficult. Contractions may continue, even while breastfeeding, but these will disappear over the next several days. And she'll start losing her hair. Most women stop losing their hair when they're pregnant, but when the pregnancy's over, so are all those great hair days. Emotionally, she's feeling a huge relief that it's finally over. She may be excited, depressed, or both. She's worried about how she'll perform as a mother and whether she'll be able to breastfeed, but over the next few weeks, her confidence will build and these worries should disappear. She's got a deep need to get to know the baby. She may be more than a little impatient at her lack of mobility, and she's got an odd sense of grief or loss at no longer being the center of attention. At the undeniable fact that, as everyone you've ever met has told you 18 million times, life will never be the same. And her sex drive may decrease. That's assuming she had any left before the baby came anyway. Postpartum blues and depression. Anywhere from 50 to 80% of new mothers get what a lot of people call baby blues, periods of mild sadness, weepiness, mood swings, exhaustion, lack of energy, loss of appetite, difficulty concentrating or making decisions, irritability or anxiety after the baby is born. This shouldn't come as much of a surprise when you think of all the sleepless nights, lack of physical intimacy, worries about not being able to cope with her new responsibilities, and those feelings of isolation that many new moms experience. Many believe that the baby blues are caused by dramatic hormonal shifts in a new mother's body. Others say the cause is lack of sleep. Anthropologist Edward Hagen, however, believes that postpartum blues have little, if anything, to do with hormones. Instead, he says, it's connected to low levels of social support, especially from the father. And it could be the new mother's way of negotiating for more involvement. Whatever the cause, the symptoms of baby blues won't really be severe enough to affect your partner's life too much. They typically start a day or two after the delivery, peak 4 or 5 days later, and in most cases, disappear on their own within a few weeks. If you notice that your partner is experiencing any of these symptoms, be as supportive and involved as possible. Take on more of the childcare responsibilities. Encourage her to rest if she can or to get out of the house for a while. Do as much of the nighttime duty as you can without jeopardizing your career, and see to it that she's eating well. Again, most of this is completely normal and nothing to worry about, so be patient and don't expect her to bounce back immediately. And don't demand that she snap out of it. For 10 to 20% of new moms, postpartum blues can develop into postpartum depression, which is more serious. Symptoms include postpartum blues that don't go away after 2 weeks, or feelings of depression or anger that surface a month or two after the birth. Feelings of sadness, doubt, guilt that she's not loving every second of motherhood, helplessness, shame if she didn't perform as she wanted to during the labor and delivery, or hopelessness that begin to disrupt your partner's normal functioning. Inability to take pleasure in activities she used to enjoy. Inability to sleep when tired or sleeping most of the time even when the baby is awake. Marked changes in appetite. Extreme concern and worry about or lack of interest in the baby and or other members of the family. And finally, worries that she'll harm the baby or herself. Pay close attention to her behavior and her attitude. If you're really concerned, and since you know her better than anyone, you'll have a good sense of whether she's behaving abnormally or not, encourage your partner to talk with you about what she's feeling and to see her doctor or a therapist. If she doesn't want to go, and many women who have postpartum depression will deny that anything is wrong, take her yourself. Sadly, a lot of moms who have postpartum depression don't get the assistance they need. They feel embarrassed to admit to anyone else what they're feeling. Untreated, these symptoms can last for years. In some cases, antidepressants may be required. You can play a major role in helping your wife get through her postpartum depression. Here are a few ways you can help. Remind her that the depression is not her fault, that you love her, that the baby loves her, that she's doing a great job, and that the two of you will get through this together. Do as much of the housework and childcare as you can so she won't have to worry about not being able to get everything done herself. Encourage her to take breaks, regularly and frequently. Take over enough of the nighttime baby duties that your partner can get at least 5 hours of uninterrupted sleep. Get regular breaks to relieve your own stress. Yes, she's relying on you to help her, but if you're falling apart yourself, you can't be an effective caregiver. A very, very important note. There's a good chance that you're going to be hearing stories about Carol Coronado, Inakashia Amour, Deanna Laney, Andrea Yates, and other new mothers who killed their children. You'll also hear, usually from reporters or TV anchors who really should know better, that these women were suffering from postpartum depression. They absolutely were not. Women with postpartum depression do not harm their children. What these women had was postpartum psychosis, a condition that affects only one or two mothers in 1,000. Symptoms usually start right after the birth and should be immediately recognizable by anyone. They include wild mood swings, hallucinations, being out of touch with reality, and making crazy or delirious statements. Postpartum psychosis is treatable, often with powerful antipsychotic drugs, but women who have it need help and they need it fast. Fortunately, despite the media hype, the majority of women with postpartum psychosis don't hurt their babies or anyone else. What's going on with you? Unconditional love. Sooner or later, almost every writer takes a crack at trying to describe love. And for the most part, we all fall short. But there's a line in Maurice Sendak's classic children's book, Where the Wild Things Are, that captures the feeling of loving one's own child exactly. "Please don't go. We'll eat you up. We love you so." As crazy as it may sound, that's precisely what my love for my daughters feels like to me. Whether we're playing, reading a book, telling each other about our days, or I'm just gazing at their smooth, peaceful faces as they sleep, all of a sudden, I'll become overcome with the desire to pick them up, mush them into tiny balls, and pop them into my mouth. If you don't already know what I mean, believe me, you soon will. Just you wait. One of my biggest fears during my wife's second pregnancy was that I wouldn't be able to love our second child as much as the first. That there wouldn't be enough of the consuming, overpowering love I felt for our first daughter to share with a new baby. But I really had nothing to worry about. 3 seconds after my second daughter was born, I already wanted to eat her up too. Same with the third. Feeling paternal. Despite all the excitement, you may be filled with a sense of calm and peacefulness. You may feel less like going to work and more like hanging out with a new family. If so, you are certainly not alone. Canadian researcher Anne Story found that new fathers' testosterone levels often drop by as much as a third right after the birth of their children. Story speculates that this kind of testosterone reduction would make a man feel more parental or more like settling down. Awe at what the female body can do. Watching your partner go through labor is a truly humbling experience. Chances are your own physical courage, strength, and resolve have rarely, if ever, been put to that kind of test. But there's nothing like seeing a baby come out of a vagina to convince you that women really are different from men. I know that vaginal birth has been around for millions of years and that that's the way babies are supposed to be born. Yet in a strange way, there's something almost unnatural about the whole process. The baby seems so big and the exit so small. Kind of reminds me of that ship-in-the-bottle conundrum. Ironically, a C-section somehow seems much more normal and humane. When the fetus is full grown, cut an appropriate-sized exit and let the baby out. Seems simple enough to me. You'd think that with all the technological advances we've made in other areas, we'd have invented a quicker, easier, less painful way to have children. Jealousy. The single emotion that can be the most destructive and disruptive to your experience of fatherhood is jealousy, says Martin Greenberg in his book, The Birth of a Father. There's certainly plenty to be jealous about, but the real question is, whom are you jealous of? Is it your partner for being able to breastfeed and for her close relationship with the baby? Or the baby for taking up more than his or her fair share of your partner's attention and for having full access to her breasts while you aren't even supposed to touch them? The answer is both. Now that the baby's born, communication with your partner is even more important than before. Jealousy's potential for destruction, says Greenberg, lies not in having the feelings, but in burying them. So if you're feeling jealous, tell her about it. But if you can't bring yourself to discuss your feelings on this issue with your partner, take them up with a male friend or relative. You'll be surprised at how common these feelings are. Feeling pushed away or left out. Almost every new father in my research, and there have been more than 1,000, has talked about feeling pushed away or excluded from the new parenting experience. The mother plays a critical role, writes Pamela Jordan. She can bring her mate into the spotlight or keep him in the wings. The most promoting mothers brought their mates into the experience by frequently and openly sharing their physical sensation and emotional responses. They actively encourage their mates to share the experience of becoming and being a father. While it's easy to give in to your feelings, throw up your hands, and leave the parenting to your partner, don't do it. Encourage her to talk to you about what she's thinking and ask her specifically to involve you as much as possible. A good way to cut down on your potential feelings of jealousy or of being pushed away is to start getting to know your baby right away, even before you leave the hospital. Change as many diapers as you can. If you've never changed one before, get one of the nurses to show you how. Give the baby a sponge bath or take him or her out for a walk while your partner rests. Be prepared, though. When you get home, you may find yourself feeling pushed away by your baby. Here's a typical scene. You're home, having a perfectly delightful time with the baby, and she starts fussing and then crying. Hard. You try everything you can to resolve the issue, but after a few minutes, it's clear that she's hungry and wants mom. Now. So you turn her over to your partner and then spend the next 20 minutes feeling inadequate, useless, and completely superfluous. Having been there many times, I guarantee that it's going to hurt. It's perfectly natural to want to distance yourself from anyone or anything that's causing you pain, but try not to take it personally. The baby isn't expressing a preference for your partner over you or saying that you're a lousy dad. It's just that mom happens to be her favorite restaurant. So instead of withdrawing, try to focus on other ways to build your own independent relationship with your child, one that's completely separate from your partner and is based on activities that don't involve feeding. Amazement at how being a parent changes everything. It's virtually impossible to try to explain the myriad ways becoming a parent will change your life. You already know you'll be responsible for the safety and well-being of a completely helpless person. You've heard that you'll lose a little sleep. Right, a lot of sleep, and even more privacy. And you've prepared yourself for not being able to read as many books or see as many movies or go to as many concerts as you did before. These are some of the big, obvious changes. But it's the tiny details that will make you realize just how different your new life is from your old one. The best way I can describe it is this. Sometimes one of my daughters would put food into her mouth, and after a few chews, change your mind, take it out, and hand it to me. Most of the time, I'd take the offering and pop it into my mouth without a second thought. You probably will too. Even more bizarre, since becoming a father, I have actually had serious discussions with my friends about the color and consistency of the contents of children's diapers. So will you. Bonding with the baby. No one knows exactly where or when it started, but one of the most widespread and most enduring myths about child rearing is that women are somehow more nurturing than men and are therefore better suited for parenting. In one of the earliest studies of father-infant interaction, my colleague, pioneering researcher Ross Park, made a discovery that came as a shock to the traditionalists. Fathers were just as caring about, just as interested in, and just as involved with their infants as the mothers were, and they held, touched, kissed, rocked, and cooed at their new babies with at least the same frequency as the mothers did. Several years later, Martin Greenberg coined a term, engrossment, to describe a father's sense of absorption, preoccupation, and interest in his baby. Park and a number of other researchers over the years have repeatedly confirmed these findings about father-infant interaction and have concluded that what triggers engrossment in men is the same thing that promotes similar nurturing feelings in women, early infant contact. The more time you spend with your baby, the stronger those feelings will be. Not surprisingly, Park and others have found that men who attend their baby's birth bonded slightly more quickly than those who didn't. But if you weren't able to be there for the birth, don't worry. Early contact at birth is not a magic pill, writes Ellen Galinsky, author of The Six Stages of Parenthood. It does not guarantee attachment, nor does lack of contact prevent bonding. Adoptive and artificial reproductive technology, or ART, dads bond too. Plenty of adoptive parents, particularly if they adopted because of infertility, feel a little insecure or inadequate, and a lot of ART parents feel the same way, especially if they aren't the baby's biological parents due to donor eggs or sperm. They often believe that the process of bonding and forming an attachment to the baby comes more naturally to birth or biological parents than to them. They're wrong. Studies of adoptive and ART parents have shown that a majority feel some kind of love for their children right from the very first contact. It doesn't matter whether it's when they go to pick up the baby, when they first look at a picture that arrived months before, or right at the birth, if they're lucky enough to be there. At the same time, though, just like biological parents, a good percentage of adoptive parents, or parents who are only partly biologically related to their child, don't feel anything particularly parental when meeting their child for the first time. If you're adopting a newborn, it's going to be a little easier to establish a bond. But a lot of adoptions aren't finalized until the babies are a few months older. Realistically, this makes the bonding process tougher for all concerned, as babies and parents take a little time to get used to each other. But it's by no means an impossible task. Being a first-time parent, whether by birth or adoption, evokes a variety of feelings, says Marshall Klaus. And although many parents feel attached to their baby at first contact, many others find that it takes a week or longer to feel the baby is theirs. If you aren't consumed with paternal feelings right away, pay special attention to the "but what if I don't fall in love right away" section that's coming up in a few minutes. In the long run, the news is good. According to researcher Susan Gollenbach and her colleagues, fathers of assisted reproduction children were found to interact more with their children and to contribute more to parenting than fathers with naturally conceived children. Postpartum depression for dads? Absolutely. According to Will Courtney, a psychotherapist specializing in male postpartum depression, as many as 1 in 4 new dads experience the kind of depression symptoms that I talked about earlier in the days, weeks, and even months after the birth of a child. Unfortunately, men rarely discuss their feelings or ask for help, especially during a time when they're supposed to be there for the new mom. One big problem is that men and women express depression differently. Women tend to get tearful and sad, men tend to get angry or withdraw from their family and retreat to the office. Because depression, including the postpartum kind, is usually seen as affecting women more than men, many mental health professionals just don't recognize the symptoms or they write them off as normal adjustment to the challenges of new parenthood. If the symptoms aren't recognized, There's no possibility of treatment, which explains why so many fathers are still showing signs of depression 9 months after the baby arrives. And of course, that whole not asking for help thing just makes it worse. The symptoms usually crop up a week or two after the birth and can include feelings of stress, irritability, or discouragement, aversion to hearing the baby cry, resentment of the baby and all the attention he gets, exhaustion, and disappointment with how you're doing as a new dad. There's been a lot of research on the negative effect of new mothers' depression on their baby. Research on the effects of dad's depression is sparse, but what there is doesn't paint a very pretty picture. As you might expect, depressed new dads have trouble bonding with their children, and children whose dads suffered from postpartum depression are about twice as likely to have behavioral, emotional, and social problems, as well as delays in language acquisition, than kids whose dads weren't depressed. While no one knows exactly what causes postpartum depression, some groups of men are more susceptible than others. The clearest risk factors are a partner who's depressed herself or who has a personal history of depression. Other factors include financial problems, a poor relationship with your partner or parents, being unmarried, or a pregnancy that had been unplanned or unwanted. Postpartum doesn't discriminate based on socioeconomic level or ethnicity. It typically affects first-time parents but can occur after subsequent births even if there were no symptoms after the first child. If you suspect that you may be experiencing postpartum depression, understand that it is not a sign of weakness. It doesn't make you a bad dad or mean that you don't love your child. It's a recognized medical condition that affects hundreds of thousands of fathers, and you shouldn't have to suffer when treatment is available. If you aren't sure, Courtney's website, postpartummen.com, offers an anonymous survey that can clarify the issues and a listing of good resources for getting help. Whatever you do, don't sweep your feelings under the rug. Depression, regardless of what triggers it, is nothing to be ashamed of, and getting treatment is important. Don't let depression rob you of the joys a new baby brings, ruin your relationships, or destroy your family. But what if I don't fall in love right away? Although we've spent a lot of time talking about the joys of loving your child and how important it is to bond with the infant as soon as possible, a lot of new fathers, and mothers for that matter, don't feel particularly close to their new baby immediately after the birth. Very few people, especially mothers, will admit in public that they feel nothing for their baby. It sounds kind of creepy, doesn't it? But in private, the truth comes out. Psychiatrists Kay Robeson and Ramesh Kumar found that 25 to 40% of mothers and fathers admitted that their first response to their baby was indifference. Putting things in slightly stronger terms, researcher Catherine May says, this bonding business is nonsense. We've sold parents a bill of goods. They believe that if they don't have skin-to-skin contact within the first 15 minutes, they won't bond. Science just doesn't show that. I have to admit that in a way, this makes a lot more sense than the love-at-first-sight kind of bonding you hear so much about. After all, you don't even know this new little person. He or she may look a lot different than you expected. And if your partner's labor and delivery were long and painful, or possibly even life-threatening, you may unconsciously be blaming the baby for the difficulties or may simply be too exhausted to fully appreciate the new arrival. He seems to do nothing but cry, eat, and fill diapers. That's on a good day. And the kid never, ever laughs at your jokes. It's downright demoralizing. And anyway, with all the extra work involved in being a new parent, who's got time to fall in love with a baby anyway? Let me assure you that if you haven't whipped yourself up into a frenzy of love for your baby, there's absolutely nothing wrong with you. More important, there's no evidence whatsoever that your relationship with or feelings for your child will be any less loving than if you'd fallen head over heels in love in the first second. Just take your time, don't pressure yourself, and don't think for a second that you've failed as a father. Almost all new dads get that bonding feeling within 2 months. There's a lot of evidence that parent-child bonding comes as a result of physical closeness. So if you'd like to speed up the process, try carrying the baby every chance you get, taking him with you whenever you can, and taking care of as many of his basic needs as possible. The whole bonding thing is probably going to be a lot tougher if you've got twins or more. Because they tend to be born somewhat more prematurely than single babies, multiples may have to stay in the hospital nursery for a few days or even weeks, which can limit the amount of time you can spend with them, separately or together. Things can get even more complicated if one of the babies comes home with you and the other, or others, stay behind. You're going to feel torn between spending time with the baby in the hospital, the other baby, and your partner. Unfortunately, there's no magic formula for how much time each of them gets. Just do the best you can and spend a lot of time talking with your partner about how you're both feeling and what each of you needs. Gee, this isn't at all what I expected. Despite everything you've heard about how gorgeous babies are, you may have a slightly different opinion, at least for the first week or so after your baby is born. If your baby was born vaginally, the trip through the birth canal may have flattened his nose and made him look a little cone-headed. Calm down. His nose will pop out and his head will get rounder over the next few months. Do those green, tar-like bowel movements make you think there's something wrong with your baby's intestines? There isn't. Those first few loads are normal and will be replaced by a much more pleasant-looking concoction as your baby starts breastfeeding. Is the baby's skin splotchy, especially on the neck and the eyelids? And does she have strange-looking birthmarks or tiny pimples? Relax. Just keep her clean, no scrubbing or zit-popping, and she'll be fine. Does your infant seem a little cross-eyed? It's fine. As soon as his eye muscles get a bit more developed and coordinated, he'll be able to look you straight in the eye. Do his hairy back and shoulders have you worrying about what'll happen to him when the moon is full? Don't. That fuzz is called lanugo, and it'll fall out pretty soon. I'm mentioning all this because there's a strong connection between depression and unmet expectations. Staying involved. The first few days. In the first few days, you're going to have to learn to juggle a lot of roles. You're still a lover and friend to your partner, and of course, you're a father. But for now, your most important role is that of support person to your partner. Besides her physical recovery, which we'll talk more about in a few minutes, she's going to need time to get to know the baby and to learn, if she chooses to, how to breastfeed. When our first daughter was born by C-section, the three of us spent 4 days in the hospital, which meant 3 uncomfortable nights on a crooked, lumpy cot for me. But when our second daughter was born, vaginally, we all checked out less than half a day after the birth. In both cases, though, my first few days at home were mighty busy, cooking, shopping, doing laundry, fixing up the baby's room, getting the word out, screening phone calls and visitors, and making sure everyone got plenty of rest. For the rest of this chapter, we'll be talking about issues that you're likely to face in the first week or two of fatherhood. We'll go into much more detail and cover a lot more ground in the sequel to this book, The New Father, A Dad's Guide to the First Year. Coming home and beyond. Within a few minutes after we'd brought our first daughter home from the hospital, my wife and I looked at each other and almost simultaneously asked, "Well, now what are we supposed to do?" An important question, no doubt, and one that seems to come up time and time again. A note on recovery. As far as the baby is concerned, there's not much to do in the beginning besides feeding, changing, and admiring. But your partner is a different story. Despite everything you've heard about women giving birth in the fields and returning to work a few minutes later, that's not the way things usually happen. Having a baby is a major shock to a woman's system, and contrary to popular belief, the recovery period after a vaginal birth is not necessarily any shorter than the recovery period after a C-section, although most women who have had both say that vaginal birth recovery is easier. Whatever kind of delivery your partner has, she'll need some time, probably more than either of you think, to fully recover. According to a recent study, more than 40% of new mothers experience fatigue and breast soreness in the first month after giving birth. In addition, vaginal discomfort, hemorrhoids, poor appetite, constipation, increased perspiration, acne, hand numbness or tingling, dizziness, and hot flashes are common for a month after delivery. And between 10 and 40% of women feel pain during sexual intercourse, have respiratory infections, and lose hair for at least 3 to 6 months. Aren't you glad you can't have a baby? Here's some things you can do to make the recovery process as easy as possible and to start parenting off on the right foot. Help your partner resist the urge to do too much too soon. Take over the household chores or ask someone else to help. If the house is a mess, don't blame each other. Be flexible. Expecting to maintain your normal pre-fatherhood schedule is unrealistic, especially for the first 6 weeks after the birth. Don't allow your relationship with your partner to be based solely on your child. If she's up to it, go on a date together and leave the baby with a relative or friend. Be patient with yourself, your partner, and the baby. You're all new at this. Be sensitive to your partner's emotions. Recovery has an emotional component as well as a physical one. Make sure to get some time alone with the baby. You can do this while your partner is sleeping or while she's out for a walk. Control the visiting hours and the number of people who can come at any given time. Dealing with visitors takes a lot more energy than you might think, and being poked, prodded, and passed around won't make the baby very happy. Also, for the first month or so, ask anyone who wants to touch the baby to wash his or her hands first. Finally, and throughout this whole thing, keep your sense of humor. Welcome home, GI Dad. Coming home to a baby who was born while you were deployed can be both exciting and terrifying. Of course, if this is your second or third or fourth child, you've already got a pretty good handle on what to expect and what you need to do. But if this is baby number one, you'll be stepping into a home that may look nothing like the one you left, and you may have no clue what to expect, what your wife will want from you, and how you'll react to this whole thing. One of the first things you'll probably feel is a conflict between wanting to jump in immediately and take care of your wife and wanting to run away as fast as you can. No question, it hasn't been easy for your wife to make it through the pregnancy and birth without you, but at least she had 9 months to prepare. Your world is going to change in an instant. Military man one minute, daddy the next. Different uniforms, similar responsibilities. Next, you'll start feeling guilty. In part for even thinking about running away, but mostly for not having been there for mom and baby during the pregnancy and birth. Get over it. The two of you knew that your being deployed was a distinct possibility, and there was absolutely nothing you could have done to change the situation. You may also feel some jealousy at the closeness of the connection between mom and baby. Try to let that one go too. There's not much you can do about it, and you wouldn't want to even if you could. Your only option is to jump in as soon as possible. Your wife will appreciate your being there to take on some of the parenting load. More important, you'll have a chance to start bonding with your baby. But don't put a lot of pressure on yourself to start bonding right away, and don't worry about trying to make up for lost time. There's no such thing. Just do as much as you can. Hug, bathe, change, feed, play, relax. Pay close attention to the staying involved sections of this chapter, and just marvel at the cool things that baby can do. And remember, A, it's never too late to start. B, the sooner you get involved, the stronger your relationship with your child. And C, you are going to make a ton of mistakes. That's another fun part of being a new daddy. The first few weeks, however, are going to be a little less fun. Even if your partner showed the baby your picture every day and played the YouTube videos you made of yourself reading bedtime stories, it's going to take a while for your baby to get used to having you around. When you hold her, she may cry, fuss, pull away from you, or cling to your wife or another more familiar caregiver. And boy, is that gonna hurt. You may be the toughest, most combat-hardened vet on earth, but that tiny infant of yours will be able to reduce you to jello in seconds. For a lot more about the special concerns of deployed dads, you may want to pick up a copy of my book, The Military Father, A Hands-On Guide for Deployed Dads. Hands-on tips for dads of preemies. If your baby was born before about 35 to 36 weeks, he may have to spend some time in an incubator, bulking up to at least 4 or 5 pounds before you can take him home. One of the things you can do to make that happen a little sooner is to massage your baby. Tiffany Field, director of the Touch Research Institute at the University of Miami School of Medicine, found that preemies who had 3 15-minute periods of gentle massage every day, in addition to their normal treatment, grew almost 50% more than those who didn't get the massage. Hospital stays were shortened by almost a week, and the bills were correspondingly lower as well. On their first birthdays, premature babies who'd been massaged were bigger and better developed than similarly premature babies who didn't get massaged. Pretty cool, eh? Helping older kids adjust to their new sibling. Handling your older children's reactions to the new baby brother or sister requires an extra touch of gentleness and sensitivity. Kids often start out wildly excited at their new status as big brother or big sister, but most will have some adjustment problems later on, as soon as they realize that the new kid is more than just a temporary visitor. Some react with anger and jealousy. Who wouldn't? For the past few years, he had you and Mom all to himself. Then, without even consulting him, you bring in someone who steals all your attention. Worse yet, the instant playmate he was hoping for turns out to be a blobby baby who does nothing but sleep, cry, eat, cry, poop, and then cry some more. And to top it off, with everyone oohing and aahing over the new baby, your older child is feeling unwanted and unloved. As a result, new older siblings may shed a few tears themselves, have tantrums, and even try to hit the baby. They need to know immediately and in no uncertain terms that you understand how they feel and that it's okay to be mad and talk about how mad they are. It's even okay to draw hateful pictures or beat up a doll, but it's absolutely not okay to do anything to hurt the baby. Others may react by regressing. My oldest daughter, for example, was completely potty trained before her sister was born, but began wetting her bed again a few weeks after we brought the new baby home. Some kids suddenly start talking baby talk again. They need more bedtime stories and cuddling, or they make demands for attention that you may not be able to satisfy. So what can you do to help your older child cope with those inevitable feelings of jealousy? If your older child comes to the hospital, keep the visit short. It won't take long for the initial excitement to wear off. And be sure to let him spend some time visiting with Mom, too. He may have been worried about her, and seeing her in a hospital bed, possibly with IV tubes hanging out of her arms, can be a scary sight. Having a chance to hug her and be reassured that she's okay is important. Tell him, often, that you and Mom love him very much and that those feelings will never change. I remember having a similar conversation with my oldest when her younger sister was born. She was afraid that if I loved the baby, I couldn't love her as much. I lit a candle and asked her to imagine that the flame was my love for her. Then I took a second candle and lit it with the flame from the first one. The second candle burned as brightly as the first, which wasn't diminished in any way. It's the same with love. Keep a few small presents around in case your older child feels left out when people bring gifts for the baby, but nothing for him. It doesn't have to be a big deal, just a little something to let him know he's special too. If you have an album or a scrapbook of him as a baby, show him the photos and tell him about the presents he received when he was born. Stress the perks of being a big kid. For example, the baby is too little to play with big kid toys or eat food that big kids do. Start fostering a relationship between your older child and the new baby by teaching big bro or sis to gently interact with the baby. Letting the older sibling help diaper, bathe, feed, and clothe the new baby is a great idea. It brings him into the process by making him feel that the baby is his. But don't force the older child to get too involved. It can make him feel as though you want him around only to wait on the more important new baby, which can make him resent the little interloper even more. Model good behavior. Show your older kids the right ways to hold and behave with a new baby. Practicing with a doll is a great, risk-free way to get the hang of it, particularly the all-important head-supporting part. If you're bottle feeding, show the older kids the right way to hold a bottle and how to recognize when the baby's had enough. Never, ever leave the baby unattended with an older sibling unless you've got a teenager. And if you do have a teen around, he or she will expect to get paid, so make sure you have plenty of cash on hand. Make sure the older child is always sitting down when holding the baby, and don't forget to praise loving, gentle behavior whenever you see it. Try to carve out some one-on-one time with your older child, doing all the activities you used to do before the baby's arrival, reading, going for walks, drawing, talking, seeing movies, or just hanging out. He may be an older sibling now, but he still needs your time, presence, and attention as much as ever. And make sure the big kid gets to spend some private time with Mom, too. A quick note on dressing children. Getting a baby dressed is not an easy task. Their heads always seem too big to go through the appropriate openings in their shirts, and their hands regularly refuse to come out of the sleeves. There are a few things you can do to make dressing a little easier. Reach through the sleeve and pull your baby's hands through. It's a lot easier than trying to shove from the other side. Buy pants or overalls with legs that snap open. Some manufacturers make baby clothes that are absolutely beautiful but impossible to put on or take off. The snap-open legs also make diaper changing much easier. You don't have to remove the whole outfit to access the diaper. Clothing legs that don't have snaps all the way to the ankles are a big pain. Elasticized cuffs aren't so easy to maneuver when the kid is squirming around on the changing table. Also, don't overdress your baby. For some strange reason, people tend to bundle their children up in all sorts of blankets, sweaters, hats, and gloves, even in the summer. But unless you're living at the North Pole, there is no reason to dress your child like an Eskimo. A basic rule of thumb is to have the baby wear the same kind of clothes you do, plus a hat. Layering clothing is sometimes a good way to go. If the baby gets too hot, you can remove a layer. Finally, I mentioned this earlier, but it's worth repeating, if they can't walk, they don't need shoes. It's not only a waste of money, but confining a baby's growing feet in a hard pair of shoes all day long can actually damage the bones. Some immediate concerns with long-term impact. Feeding the baby, breast versus bottle. When you were a baby, breastfeeding was probably out of style, and there's a pretty good chance that your mom's doctors gave her a wide variety of reasons not to breastfeed. But these days, breasts are back, big time. So much so that it's pretty hard these days to find anyone who doesn't advocate breastfeeding. Even in the medical community, there's a general agreement that breastfeeding is just about the best thing you can do for your child. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that new babies get nothing but breast milk for the first 6 months, and that breast milk should be then phased out and solid food phased in over the next six. If you and your partner haven't already decided to breastfeed, here are the reasons why you should. Besides the fact that you'll get a lot of nasty looks from people if you don't. For the baby, breast milk provides exactly the right balance of nutrients needed by your newborn. In addition, breast milk contains several essential fatty acids that are not found in baby formula. Breast milk adapts, as if by magic, to your baby's changing nutritional needs. None of my children had a single sip of anything but breast milk for the first 6 or 7 months of life, and they're all incredibly healthy kids. Breastfeeding greatly reduces the chance that your baby will develop food allergies. If your family or your partner's has a history of food allergies, your pediatrician may advise you to withhold solid foods for a few more months. Breastfed babies are less likely to become obese as adults than formula-fed babies. This may be because with the breast, it's the baby, not the parent, who decides when to quit eating. Breastfed babies have a lower risk of developing asthma, stomach problems, diabetes, cavities, pneumonia, ear infections, childhood leukemia, and sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. Breastfeeding is thought to transmit to the infant the mother's immunity to certain diseases. This is especially important for the first few months until the baby's immune system matures. Finally, breastfed babies may have higher IQs than their non-breastfed buddies. For you and your partner, it's convenient. No preparation, no heating, no bottles or dishes to wash. It's free. Formula can cost a lot of money. It gives your partner a wonderful opportunity to bond with the baby. In addition, breastfeeding will help get your partner's uterus back into shape and may reduce her risk of ovarian and breast cancer, type 2 diabetes, and postpartum depression. In most cases, there's always as much as you need and never any waste. Your baby's diapers won't stink. It's true. Breastfed babies produce stool that, at least compared to real food stool, doesn't smell half bad. A special note on breastfeeding. As natural as breastfeeding is, your partner and the baby may need anywhere from a few days to a few weeks to get the hang of it. The baby may not immediately know how to latch onto the breast properly, and your partner, never having done this before, won't know exactly what to do either. This initial period, in which cracked and even bloody nipples are not uncommon, may be quite painful for your partner. And with the baby feeding 6 or 7 times a day, it may take as long as 2 weeks for your partner's nipples to get sufficiently toughened up. Surprisingly, she won't begin producing any real milk until 2 to 5 days after the baby is born. But there's no need to worry that the baby isn't getting enough food. Babies don't eat much in the first day or two, and the sucking they do is almost purely for practice. Whatever nutritional needs your baby has will be fully satisfied by the tiny amounts of colostrum your partner produces. Colostrum is a kind of pre-milk that helps the baby's immature digestive system get warmed up for the task of dealing with the real stuff later. Overall, the first few weeks of breastfeeding can be very stressful for your partner. If this is the case, don't be tempted to suggest switching the bottles. Instead, be supportive. Praise her for the great job she's doing. Bring her something to eat or drink while she's feeding, and encourage her to keep trying. You also might want to ask your pediatrician for the name of a local lactation consultant. Yes, there really is such a thing. Many hospitals have them on staff, and they'll stop by your room to give your partner some coaching before you head back home. To give you a sense of how much of an on-the-job training activity breastfeeding is, the lactation consultant the hospital sent to our room when our first daughter was born was a male nurse. Despite not having breasts, he was actually able to show my wife how to do it. Your support is particularly important. Research shows that women whose husbands are supportive and encouraging breastfeed longer and are happier with the decision, an outcome that's good for everyone. Feeding twins. Although there's no question that breastfeeding is best, nursing two infants at the same time often presents some real complications. First of all, for the first few weeks or so, each of them is going to want to eat every 2 or 3 hours. Sometimes they'll be hungry at the same time, sometimes not. Ideally, you'll be able to get them both on the same feeding schedule. That's not always easy, though, because typically one will want to eat more often than the other. If that's the case for you, a lot of nursing moms find it easier to start serving both babies whenever the hungrier one wants it. Either way, by the time the feedings are over and the diapers are changed, it'll be just about time to start again, which will leave your partner feeling something like a 24-hour drive-through milk bar. In a valiant attempt to give themselves some downtime, a lot of new mothers of twins opt for a mix of breast and bottle feeding. The bottles can be filled with either breast milk, which can be pumped out faster than a baby can suck it out, or formula. Either way, if you've got twins, you're really going to have to be a lot more involved in feeding them than you otherwise might have been. A note on SIDS. Sudden infant death syndrome, which affects otherwise healthy babies, is one of the scariest issues confronting new parents, and there's good reason. Every year, SIDS claims between 2,000 and 4,000 lives. It's the most common cause of death of children between 1 week and 1 year old, striking about one in every 1,000 babies. Despite all the millions of dollars spent on researching and fighting SIDS, no one's quite sure what exactly causes it, and there's no medical test to determine which babies are at the greatest risk. That said, here's what we do know. It's most likely to strike infants 2 to 4 months old. 90% of deaths happen by 6 months. It's more likely to happen to boys than girls. Other risk groups include preemies, multiple birth babies, babies whose mothers are under 18, African American families or Native American families, and in families in which a parent or caretaker smokes. It's more common in cold weather when respiratory infections and overheating are more prevalent, and it is not caused by vaccinations. Since 2/3 of SIDS babies don't fall into any of the highest risk categories, there are a few things you can do to minimize the risk. First, put your baby to sleep on his back. Experts used to think that babies who slept on their backs would choke on their vomit if they spit up. Turns out that's not true. Babies are smart enough to turn their heads. People also preferred to put their babies on their tummies as a way to avoid getting bald or flat spots on the back of the head. Now we know that tummy sleeping may double or triple the risk. Since the Back to Sleep campaign began, SIDS deaths have dropped by 43%. One thing, though, babies who sleep on their backs don't get to exercise their arms as much, and they take longer to learn to push themselves up and roll over. So make sure your baby spends plenty of his awake time on his belly, working out that upper body. Don't smoke, and don't let anyone who does near your baby. While it's not possible to say that smoking directly increases SIDS risk, there does seem to be a connection. Don't overdress the baby. Put the baby to sleep on a firm mattress. No pillows, no fluffy blankets, plush sofas, water beds, shag carpets, or beanbags. The crib mattress should fit snugly into the crib so the baby can't slip in between it and the frame. Take out anything else, such as stuffed animals or extra blankets that might accidentally cover the baby. Breastfeed. As with not smoking, while there's no definite proof that breastfeeding actually reduces the risk, there seems to be a connection. Give your baby a pacifier. No one's